Chapter 75. I almost died, you know, Nick said. He and Tom were walking up the empty sidewalk together. The wind howled steadily, an endless ghost train highballing through the black sky. It made odd, low hooting noises in the alleyways. Hants, Tom would have said awake, and run away. But he wasn't awake, not exactly, and Nick was with him. Sleet smacked coldly against his cheeks.
"You did?" Tom asked. "My laws."
Nick laughed. His voice was low and musical, a good voice. Tom loved to listen to him talk.
"I sure did. That's a big laws, yes. The flu didn't get me, but a little scratch along the leg almost did. Here, look at this."
Seemingly oblivious of the cold, Nick unbuckled his jeans and pushed them down. Tom bent forward curiously, no different from any small boy who has been offered a glimpse of a wart with hair growing out of it, or an interesting wound or puncture. Running down Nick's leg was an ugly scar, barely healed. It started just below the groin, in the slab part of the thigh, and corkscrewed past the knee to mid-shin, where it finally petered out.
"And that almost killed you?"
Nick pulled up his jeans and belted them.
"It wasn't deep, but it got infected. Infection means that the bad germs got into it. Infection's the most dangerous thing there is, Tom. Infection was what made the superflu germ kill all the people. And infection is what made people want to make the germ in the first place. An infection of the mind."
"Infection," Tom whispered, fascinated. They were walking again, almost floating along the sidewalk.
"Tom, Stu's got an infection now."
"No.
No, don't say that, Nick. You're scaring Tom Cullen. Laws, yes, you are."
"I know I am, Tom, and I'm sorry. But you have to know. He has pneumonia in both lungs. He's been sleeping outside for nearly 2 weeks. There are things you have to do for him. And still, he'll almost certainly die. You have to be prepared for that."
"No, don't, Tom."
Nick put his hand on Tom's shoulder, but Tom felt nothing. It was as if Nick's hand was nothing but smoke.
"If he dies, you and Kojak have to go on. You have to get back to Boulder and tell them that you saw the hand of God in the desert. If it's God's will, Stu will go with you, in time. If it's God's will that Stu should die, then he will. Like me."
"Nick," Tom begged. "Please, I showed you my leg for a reason. There are pills for infections, in places like this."
Tom looked around and was surprised to see that they were no longer on the street. They were in a dark store, a drug store. A wheelchair was suspended on piano wire from the ceiling like a ghostly mechanical corpse. A sign on Tom's right advertised Continence Supplies.
"Yes, sir, may I help you?"
Tom whirled around. Nick was behind the counter in a white coat.
"Nick?"
"Yes, sir."
Nick began to put small bottles of pills in front of Tom.
"This is penicillin, very good for pneumonia. This is ampicillin, and this one's amoxicillin, also good stuff. And this is V-cillin, most commonly given to children, and it may work if the others don't. He's to drink lots of water, and he should have juices, but that may not be possible, so give him these, they're vitamin C tablets. Also, he must be walked—"
"I can't remember all of that,"
Tom wailed.
"I'm afraid you'll have to, because there is no one else. You're on your own."
Tom began to cry. Nick leaned forward. His arm swung. There was no slap. Again, there was only that feeling that Nick was smoke which had passed around him and possibly through him. But Tom felt his head rock back all the same. Something in his head seemed to snap.
"Stop that. You can't be a baby now, Tom. Be a man. For God's sake, be a man."
Tom stared at Nick, his hand on his cheek, his eyes wide.
"Walk him," Nick said. "Get him on his good leg. Drag him if you have to, but get him off his back or he'll drown."
"He isn't himself," Tom said. "He shouts. He shouts to people who aren't there.
He's delirious. Walk him anyway, all you can. Make him take the penicillin, one pill at a time. Give him aspirin. Keep him warm. Pray. Those are all the things you can do.
All right, Nick. All right, I'll try to be a man. I'll try to remember. But I wish you was here. Laws, yes, I do.
You do your best, Tom. That's all. Nick was gone. Tom woke up and found himself standing in the deserted drugstore by the prescription counter. Standing on the glass were four bottles of pills. Tom stared at them for a long time, and then gathered them up. Tom came back at 4 in the morning, his shoulders frosted with sleet. Outside it was letting up, and there was a thin, clean line of dawn in the east. Kojak barked an ecstatic welcome, and Stu moaned and woke up. Tom knelt beside him.
Stu? Tom? Hard to breathe. I've got medicine, Stu. Nick showed me.
You take it and get rid of that infection. You have to take one right now. From the bag he had brought in, Tom produced the four bottles of pills and a tall bottle of Gatorade. Nick had been wrong about the juice. There was plenty of bottled juice in the Green River Superette. Stu looked at the pills, holding them closely to his eyes.
Tom, where did you get these?
In the drugstore. Nick gave them to me.
No, really.
Really, really. You have to take the penicillin first to see if that works. Which one says penicillin?
This one does. But, Tom...
No, you have to. Nick said so. And you have to walk.
I can't walk. I got a bust leg. And I'm sick.
Stu's voice became sulky, petulant. It was a sick room voice. You have to, or I'll drag you, Tom said. Stu lost his tenuous grip on reality. Tom put one of the penicillin capsules in his mouth, and Stu reflex swallowed it with Gatorade to keep from choking. He began to cough wretchedly anyway, and Tom pounded him on the back as if he were burping a baby. Then he hauled Stu to his good foot by main force and began to drag him around the lobby, Kojak following them anxiously.
Please, God, Tom said. Please, God, please, God.
Stu cried out,
I know where I can get her a washboard, Glenn. That music store has 'em. I seen one in the window. Please, God, Tom panted.
Stu's head lolled on his shoulder. It felt as hot as a furnace. His splinted leg dragged uselessly. Boulder had never seemed so far away as it did on that dismal morning. Stu's struggle with pneumonia lasted 2 weeks. He drank quarts of Gatorade, V8, Welch's grape juice, and various brands of orange drink. He rarely knew what he was drinking. His urine was strong and acidic. He messed himself like a baby, and like a baby's, his stools were yellow and loose and totally blameless. Tom kept him clean. Tom dragged him around the lobby of the Utah Hotel, and Tom waited for the night when he would wake, not because Stu was raving in his sleep, but because his labored breathing had finally ceased. The penicillin produced an ugly red rash after 2 days, and Tom switched to the ampicillin. That was better. On October 7th, Tom awoke in the morning to find Stu sleeping more deeply than he had in days. His entire body was soaked with sweat, but his forehead was cool. The fever had snapped in the night. For the next 2 days, Stu did little but sleep. Tom had to struggle to wake him up enough to take his pills and sugar cubes from the restaurant attached to the Utah Hotel. He relapsed on October 11th, and Tom was terribly afraid it was the end. But the fever did not go as high, and his respiration never got as thick and labored as it had been on those terrifying early mornings of the 5th and the 6th. On October 13th, Tom awoke from a dazed nap in one of the lobby chairs to find Stu sitting up and looking around.
Tom, he whispered, I'm alive.
Yes, Tom said joyfully.
Laws, yes. I'm hungry. Could you rustle up some soup, Tom, with noodles in it, maybe?
By the 18th, his strength had begun to come back a little. He was able to get around the lobby for 5 minutes at a time on the crutches Tom brought him from the drugstore. There was a steady, maddening itch from his broken leg as the bones began to knit themselves together. On October 20th, He went outside for the first time, bundled up in thermal underwear and a huge sheepskin coat. The day was warm and sunny, but with an undertone of coolness. In Boulder it might still be mid-fall, the aspens turning gold, but here winter was almost close enough to touch. He could see small patches of frozen, granulated snow in shadow areas the sun never touched.
"I don't know, Tom," he said. "I think we can get over to Grand Junction, but after that I just don't know. There's going to be a lot of snow in the mountains, and I don't dare move for a while anyway. I've got to get my go back."
"How long before your go comes back, Stu?"
"I don't know, Tom. We'll just have to wait and see."
Stu was determined not to move too quickly, not to push it. He had been close enough to death to relish his recovery. They wanted it to be as complete as it could be. They moved out of the hotel lobby into a pair of connecting rooms down the first-floor hall. The room across the way became Kojak's temporary doghouse. Stu's leg was indeed knitting, but because of the improper set, it was never going to be the same straight limb again, unless he got George Richardson to re-break it and set it properly. When he got off the crutches, he was going to have a limp. Nevertheless, he set to work exercising it, trying to tone it up. Bringing the leg back to even 75% efficiency was going to be a long process, but so far as he could tell, he had a whole winter to do it in. On October 28th, Green River was dusted with nearly 5 inches of snow. "If we don't make our move soon," Stu told Tom as they looked out at the snow, "we'll be spending the whole damn winter in the Utah Hotel." The next day, they drove the Plymouth down to the gas station on the outskirts of town. Pausing often to rest and using Tom for the heavy work, they changed the balding back tires for a pair of studded snows. Stu considered taking a four-wheel drive and had finally decided, quite irrationally, that they should stick with their luck. Tom finished the operation by loading 4 50-pound bags of sand into the Plymouth's trunk. They left Green River on Halloween and headed east. They reached Grand Junction at noon on November 2nd, with not much more than 3 hours to spare, as it turned out. The skies had been lead gray all the forenoon, and as they turned down the main street, the first spits of snow began to skate across the Plymouth's hood. They had seen brief flurries half a dozen times en route, but this was not going to be a flurry. The sky promised serious snow.
"Pick your spot," Stu said. "We may be here for a while."
Tom pointed. "There, the motel with the star on it." The motel with the star on it was the Grand Junction Holiday Inn. Below the sign and the beckoning star was a marquee, and written on it in large red letters was, "Welcome to Grand Junction's Summerfest 90, June 12th to July 4th.
"Okay," Stu said, "Holiday Inn it is."
He pulled in and killed the Plymouth's engine, and so far as either of them knew, it never ran again. By 2 that afternoon, the spits and spats of snow had developed into a thick white curtain that fell soundlessly and seemingly endlessly. By 4 o'clock, the light wind had turned into a gale, driving the snow before it and piling up drifts that grew with a speed which was almost hallucinatory. It snowed all night. When Stu and Tom got up the next morning, they found Kojak sitting in front of the big double doors in the lobby, looking out at a nearly moveless world of white. Nothing moved but a single blue jay that was strutting around on the crushed remnants of a summer awning across the street.
"Jeezly crow," Tom whispered. "We're snowed in, ain't we, Stu?"
Stu nodded.
"How can we get back to Boulder in this?"
"We wait for spring," Stu said.
"That long?"
Tom looked distressed, and Stu put an arm around the big man-boy's shoulders. "The time will pass," he said. But even then, he was not sure either of them would be able to wait that long. Stu had been moaning and gasping in the darkness for some time. At last he gave a cry loud enough to wake himself up and came out of the dream to his Holiday Inn motel room up on his elbows, staring wide-eyed at nothing. He let out a long, shivery sigh and fumbled for the lamp by the bed table. He had clicked it twice before everything came back. It was funny how hard that belief in electricity died. He found the Coleman lamp on the floor and lit that instead. When he had it going, he used the chamber pot. Then he sat down in the chair by the desk. He looked at his watch and saw it was 3:15 in the morning. The dream again. The Franny dream. The nightmare. It was always the same. Franny in pain, her face bathed in sweat. Richardson was between her legs, and Laurie Constable was standing nearby to assist him. Fran's feet were up in stainless steel stirrups. "Push, Franny. Bear down. You're doing fine." But looking at George's somber eyes over the top of his mask, Stu knew that Franny wasn't doing fine at all. Something was wrong. Laurie sponged off her sweaty face and pushed back her hair from her forehead.
"Breech birth."
Who had said that? It was a sinister, bodiless voice, low and draggy, like a voice on a 45 RPM record played at 33 1/3.
"Breech birth."
George's voice. "You'd better call Dick. Tell him we may have to." Laurie's voice. "Doctor, she's losing a lot of blood now." Stu lit a cigarette. It was terribly stale, but after that particular dream, anything was a comfort. "It's an anxiety dream, that's all. You got this typical macho idea that things won't come right if you're not there. Well, bag it up, Stuart. She's fine. Not all dreams come true." But too many of them had come true during the last half year. The feeling that he was being shown the future in this recurring dream of Fran's delivery would not leave him. He stubbed the cigarette out, half-smoked, and looked blankly into the gas lamp's steady glow. It was November 29th. They had been quartered in the Grand Junction Holiday Inn for nearly 4 weeks. The time had passed slowly, but they had managed to keep amused with a whole town to plunder for diverting odds and ends. Stu had found a medium-sized Honda electrical generator in a supply house on Grand Avenue, and he and Tom had hauled it back to the convention hall across from the Holiday Inn by putting it onto a sled with a chainfall and then hooking up 2 snowcats to the sledge, moving it, in other words, in much the same way that Trash Can Man had moved his final gift for Randall Flagg. "What are we going to do with it?" Tom asked. "Get the electricity going at the motel?" "This is too small for that," Stu said. "What then? What's it for?" Tom was fairly dancing with impatience. "You'll see," Stu said. They put the generator in the convention hall's electrical closet, and Tom promptly forgot about it, which was just what Stu had hoped for. The next day he went to the Grand Junction Sixplex by snowmobile, and using the sledge and the chainfall himself this time, he had lowered an old 35mm motion picture projector from the second-story window of the storage area where he had found it on one of his exploring trips. It had been wrapped in plastic, and then simply forgotten, judging by the dust which had gathered on the protective covering. His leg was coming around nicely, but it had still taken him almost 3 hours to muscle the projector from the doorway of the convention hall into the center of the floor. He used 3 dollies and kept expecting Tom to happen by at any moment looking for him. With Tom to pitch in, the work would have gone faster, but it also would have spoiled the surprise. But Tom was apparently off on business of his own, and Stu didn't see him all day. When he came into the Holiday Inn around 5, apple-cheeked and wrapped in a scarf, the surprise was all ready. Stu had brought back all 6 of the movies which had been playing in the Grand Junction cinema complex. After supper that evening, Stu said casually, "Come on over to the convention hall with me, Tom." "What for?" "You'll see." The convention hall faced the Holiday Inn across the snowy street. Stu handed Tom a box of popcorn at the doorway. "What's this for?" Tom asked. "Can't watch a movie without popcorn, you big dummy," Stu grinned.
"Movie?"
"Sure." Tom burst into the convention hall, saw the big projector set up, completely threaded.
saw the big convention movie screen pulled down, saw two folding chairs set up in the middle of the huge empty floor.
"Wow," he whispered, and his expression of naked wonder had been all Stu could have hoped for.
"I did this 3 summers at the Starlight Drive-In over in Braintree," Stu said. "I hope I ain't forgot how to fix one of these bastards if the film breaks."
"Wow," Tom said again.
"We'll have to wait in between reels. I wasn't about to go back and grab a second one." Stu stepped through the welter of patch cords leading from the projector to the Honda generator in the electrical closet and pulled the starter cord. The generator began to chug cheerfully along. Stu shut the door as far as it would go to mute the engine sound and killed the lights. And 5 minutes later they were sitting side by side, watching Sylvester Stallone kill hundreds of dope dealers in Rambo 4, The Firefight. Dolby sound blared out at them from the convention hall's 16 speakers, sometimes so loud it was hard to hear the dialogue, what dialogue there was, but they both loved it. Now, thinking about that, Stu smiled. Someone who didn't know better would have called him dumb. He could have hooked a VCR up to a much smaller Jenny, and they could have watched hundreds of movies that way, probably right in the Holiday Inn. But movies on TV were not the same, never had been, to his way of thinking. And that wasn't really the point, either. The point was simply that they had time to kill. And some days, it died goddamned hard. Anyway, one of the films had been a reissue of one of the last Disney cartoons, Oliver and Company, which had never been released on videotape. Tom watched it again and again, laughing like a child at the antics of Oliver and the Artful Dodger and Fagin, who in the cartoon lived on a barge in New York and slept in a stolen airline seat. In addition to the movie project, Stu had built over 20 models, including a Rolls-Royce that had 240 parts and had sold for $65 before the Superflu. Tom had built a strange but somehow compelling terrain-contoured landscape that covered nearly half the floor space of the Holiday Inn's main function room. He had used papier-mâché, plaster of Paris, and various food colorings. He called it Moonbase Alpha. Yes, they had kept busy, but what you're thinking is crazy. He flexed his leg. It was in better shape than he ever would have hoped, partially thanks to the Holiday Inn's weight room and exercising machines. There was still considerable stiffness and some pain, but he was able to limp around without the crutches. They could take it slow and easy. He was quite sure he could show Tom how to run one of the Arctic cats that almost everyone around here kept packed away in the back of their garages. Do 20 miles a day, pack shelter halves, big sleeping bags, plenty of those freeze-dried concentrates. Sure. And when the avalanche comes down on you up in Vale Pass, you and Tom can wave a pack of freeze-dried carrots at it and tell it to go away. It's crazy. Still, he crushed his smoke and turned off the gas lamp. But it was a long time before he slept. Over breakfast, he said, "Tom, how badly do you want to get back to Boulder?"
"And see Fran, Dick, Sandy? Laws, I want to get back to Boulder worse than anything, Stu." "You don't think they gave my little house away, do you?"
"No, I'm sure they didn't. What I mean is, would it be worth it to you to take a chance?" Tom looked at him, puzzled. Stu was getting ready to try and explain further when Tom said,
"Laws, everything's a chance, isn't it?"
It was decided as simply as that. They left Grand Junction on the last day of November. There was no need to teach Tom the fundamentals of snowmobiling. Stu found a monster machine in a Colorado Highway Department shed not a mile from the Holiday Inn. It had an oversized engine, a fairing to cut the worst of the wind, and most important of all, it had been modified to include a large open storage compartment. It had once, no doubt, held all manner of emergency gear. The compartment was big enough to take one good-sized dog comfortably. With the number of shops in town devoted to outdoor activities,
They had no trouble at all in outfitting themselves for the trip, even though the superflu had struck at the beginning of summer. They took light shelter halves and heavy sleeping bags, a pair of cross-country skis each, although the thought of trying to teach Tom the fundamentals of cross-country skiing made Stu's blood run cold. A big Coleman gas stove, lamps, gas bottles, extra batteries, concentrated foods, and a big Garand rifle with a scope. By 2 o'clock of that first day, Stu saw that his fear of being snowed in someplace and starving to death was groundless. The woods were fairly crawling with game. He had never seen anything like it in his life. Later that afternoon, he shot a deer, his first deer since the 9th grade, when he had played hooky from school to go out hunting with his Uncle Dale. That deer had been a scrawny doe whose meat had been wild-tasting and rather bitter, from eating nettles, Uncle Dale said. This one was a buck, fine and heavy and broad-chested. But then, Stu thought as he gutted it with a big knife he had liberated from a Grand Junction sporting goods store, the winter had just started. Nature had her own way of dealing with overpopulation. Tom built a fire while Stu butchered the deer as best he could, getting the sleeves of his heavy coat stiff and tacky with blood. By the time he was done with the deer, it had been dark 3 hours, and his bad leg was singing Ave Maria. The deer he had gotten with his Uncle Dale had gone to an old man named Showy, who lived in a shack just over the Braintree town line. He had skinned and dressed the deer for $3 and 10 pounds of deer meat. "I sure wish old man Showy was here tonight," he said with a sigh. "Who?" Tom asked, coming out of a semi-doze. "No one, Tom. Talking to myself." As it turned out, the venison was worth it. Sweet and delicious. After they had eaten their fill, Stu cooked about 30 pounds of extra meat and packed it away in one of the highway department's snowmobiles' smaller storage compartments the next morning. That first day, they only made 16 miles. That night, the dream changed. He was in the delivery room again. There was blood everywhere. The sleeves of the white coat he was wearing were stiff and tacky with it. The sheet covering Franny was soaked through, and still she shrieked. "It's coming," George panted. "Its time has come round at last, Franny. It's waiting to be born, so push, push." And it came. It came in a final freshet of blood. George pulled the infant free, grasping the hips because it had come feet first. Lori began to scream. Stainless steel instruments sprayed everywhere. Because it was a wolf with a furious, grinning human face, his face. It was Flag. His time come round again. He was not dead, not dead yet. He still walked the world. Franny had given birth to Randall Flag. Stu woke up, his harsh breathing loud in his ears. Had he screamed? Tom was still asleep, huddled so deeply in his sleeping bag that Stu could only see his cowlick. Kojak was curled at Stu's side. Everything was all right. It had only been a dream. And then a single howl rose in the night, climbing, ululating, a silver chime of desperate horror, the howl of a wolf, or perhaps the scream of a killer's ghost. Kojak raised his head. Goose flesh broke out on Stu's arms, thighs, groin. The howl didn't come again. Stu slept. In the morning, they packed up and went on. It was Tom who noticed and pointed out that the deer guts were all gone. There was a flurry of tracks where they had been, and the bloodstain of Stu's kill faded to a dull pink on the snow. But that was all. 5 days of good weather brought them to Rifle. The next morning they awoke to a deepening blizzard. Stu said he thought they should wait it out here, and they put up in a local motel. Tom held the lobby doors open, and Stu drove the snowmobile right inside. As he told Tom, it made a handy garage, although the snowmobile's heavy-duty tread had chewed up the lobby's deep pile rug considerably. It snowed for 3 days. When they awoke on the morning of December 10th and dug themselves out, the sun was shining brightly and the temperature had climbed into the mid-30s. The snow was much deeper now, and it had gotten more difficult to read the twists and turns of I-70.
but it wasn't keeping to the highway that worried Stu on that bright, warm, and sunny day. In the late afternoon, as the blue shadows began to lengthen, Stu throttled down and then killed the snowmobile's engine, his head cocked, his whole body seeming to listen.
"What is it, Stu? What's—"
Then Tom heard it too, a low rumbling sound off to their left and up ahead. It swelled to a deep express train roar and then faded. The afternoon was still again.
"Stu?"
Tom asked anxiously. "Don't worry," he said, and thought, "I'll worry enough for both of us." The warm temperatures held. By December 13th, they were nearly to Shoshone, and still climbing toward the roof of the Rockies. For them, the highest point they would reach before beginning to descend again would be Loveland Pass. Again and again they heard the low rumble of avalanches, sometimes far away, sometimes so close that there was nothing to do but look up and wait and hope those great shelves of white death would not blot out the sky. On the 12th, one swept down and over a place where they had been only half an hour before, burying the snowmobile's track under tons of packed snow. Stu was increasingly afraid that the vibration caused by the sound of the snowmobile's engine would be what finally killed them, triggering a slide that would bury them 40 feet deep before they even had time enough to realize what was happening. But now there was nothing to do but press on and hope for the best. Then the temperatures plunged again and the threat abated somewhat. There was another storm and they were stopped for 2 days. They dug out and went on, and at night the wolves howled. Sometimes they were far away, sometimes so close they seemed right outside the shelter halves, bringing Kojak to his feet, growling low in his chest, as taut as a steel spring. But the temperatures remained low and the frequency of the avalanches diminished, although they had another near miss on the 18th. On December 22nd, outside the town of Avon, Stu ran the snowmobile off the highway embankment. At one moment they were running along at a steady 10 miles an hour, safe and fine, spuming up clouds of snow behind them. Tom had just pointed out the small village below, silent as a 1980s stereopticon image with its single white church steeple and the undisturbed drifts up to the eaves of the houses. The next moment the cowling of the snowmobile began to tilt forward.
"What the fuck?" Stu began,
and that was all he had time for. The snowmobile canted farther forward. Stu throttled back, but it was too late. There was a peculiar sensation of weightlessness, the feeling you have when you have just left the diving board and the pull of gravity just matches the force of your upward spring. They were pitched off the machine head over heels. Stu lost sight of Tom and Kojak, cold snow up his nose. When he opened his mouth to shout, the snow went down his throat, down the back of his coat, tumbling, falling, finally coming to rest in a deep white quilt of snow. He fought his way up like a swimmer, gasping hot fire. His throat had been snow-burned.
"Tom!"
he shouted, treading snow. Oddly enough, from this angle he could see the highway embankment very clearly and where they had run off it, causing their own small avalanche as they did so. The rear end of the snowmobile jutted out of the snow about 50 feet farther down the steep gradient. It looked like an orange buoy. Strange how the water imagery persisted. And by the way, was Tom drowning?
"Tom! Tommy!"
Kojak popped up, looking as if he had been dusted from stem to stern with confectioner's sugar, and breasted his way through the snow toward Stu.
"Kojak!" Stu shouted. "Find Tom! Find Tom!"
Kojak barked and struggled to turn around. He headed toward a churned-up place in the snow and barked again. Struggling, falling, eating snow, Stu got to the place and felt around. One gloved hand snagged Tom's jacket, and he gave a furious yank. Tom bobbed up, gasping and retching, and they both fell on top of the snow on their backs. Tom whooped and gasped.
"My throat! It's all hot! Oh, laws, lawsy me!"
"It's the cold, Tom. It goes away."
"I was choking."
"It's all right now, Tom. We're going to be okay."
They lay on top of the snow, getting their wind back. Stu put his arm around Tom's shoulders to still the big fellow's trembling. A distance away, gaining volume and then diminishing, was the rumbling, cold sound of another avalanche. It took them the rest of the day to get the 3/4 of a mile between the place where they had run off the road and the town of Avon. There was no question of salvaging the snowmobile or any of the supplies lashed to it. It was just too far down the grade. It would stay there until spring, at least. Maybe forever, the way things were now. They got to town 30 minutes past dusk, too cold and winded to do anything but build a fire and find a halfway warm place to sleep. That night, there were no dreams, only the blackness of utter exhaustion. In the morning, they set about the task of re-outfitting themselves. It was a tougher job in the small town of Avon than it had been in Grand Junction. Again, Stu considered just stopping and wintering here. If he said it was the right thing to do, Tom would not question him, and they had had an explicit lesson in what happened to people who pressed their luck just yesterday. But in the end, he rejected the idea. The baby was due sometime in early January. He wanted to be there when it came. He wanted to see with his own eyes that it was all right. At the end of Avon's short main street, they found a John Deere dealership, and in the garage behind the snow room they found 2 used Deere snowmobiles. Neither of them was quite as good as the big highway department machine Stu had driven off the road, but one of them had an extra-wide cleated driving tread, and he thought it would do. They found no concentrates and had to settle for canned goods instead. The latter half of the day was spent ransacking houses for camping gear, a job neither of them relished. The victims of the plague were everywhere, transformed into grotesquely decayed ice cave exhibits. Near the end of the day, they found most of what they needed in one place, a large rooming house just off the main drag. Before the superflu struck, it had apparently been filled with young people, the sort who came to Colorado to do all the things John Denver used to sing about. Tom, in fact, found a large green plastic garbage bag in the crawl space under the stairs, filled with a very potent version of Rocky Mountain High.
"What's this? Is it tobacco, Stu?"
Stu grinned. "Well, I guess some people thought so. It's loco weed, Tom. Leave it where you found it." They loaded the snowmobile carefully, storing away the canned goods, tying down new sleeping bags and shelter halves. By then, the first stars were coming out, and they decided to spend one more night in Avon. Driving slowly back over the crusting snow to the house where they had set up quarters, Stu had a quietly stunning thought. Tomorrow would be Christmas Eve. It seemed impossible to believe that time could have gotten by so fast, but the proof was staring up at him from his calendar wristwatch. They had left Grand Junction over 3 weeks before. When they reached the house, Stu said, "You and Kojak go on in and get the fire going. I got a small errand to run."
"What's that, Stu?"
"Well, it's a surprise," Stu said.
"Surprise? Am I going to find out?"
"Yeah."
"When?"
Tom's eyes sparkled.
"Couple of days." "Tom Cullen can't wait a couple of days for a surprise, laws, no."
"Tom Cullen will just have to," Stu said with a grin.
"I'll be back in an hour. You just be ready to go." "Well, okay."
It was more like an hour and a half before Stu had exactly what he wanted. Tom pestered him about the surprise for the next 2 or 3 hours. Stu kept mum, and by the time they turned in, Tom had forgotten all about it. As they lay in the dark, Stu said, "I bet by now you wish we'd stayed in Grand Junction, huh?"
"Laws, no," Tom answered sleepily. "I want to get back to my little house just as fast as I can. I just hope we don't run off the road and fall into the snow again. Tom Cullen almost choked."
"We'll just have to go slower and try harder," Stu said, not mentioning what would probably happen to them if it did happen again, and there was no shelter within walking distance.
"When do you think we'll be there, Stu?"
"It'll be a while yet, old hoss, but we're getting there. And I think what we better do right now is get some sleep, don't you?"
"I guess."
Stu turned out the light. That night he dreamed that both Franny and her terrible wolf child had died in childbirth. He heard George Richardson saying from a great distance, "It's the flu. No more babies because of the flu. Pregnancy is death because of the flu. A chicken in every pot and a wolf in every womb. Because of the flu. We're all done. Mankind is done. Because of the flu." And from somewhere nearer, closing in, came the dark man's howling laughter. On Christmas Eve, they began a run of good traveling that would last almost until the new year. The surface of the snow had crusted up in the cold. The wind blew swirling clouds of ice crystals over it to pile up in powdery herringbone dunes that the John Deere snowmobile cut through easily. They wore sunglasses to guard against snow blindness. They camped that Christmas Eve on top of the crust 24 miles east of Avon, not far from Silverthorn. They were in the throat of Loveland Pass now, the choked and buried Eisenhower Tunnel somewhere below and to the east of them. While they were waiting for dinner to warm up, Stu discovered an amazing thing. Idly using an axe to chop through the crust and his hand to dig out the loose powder beneath, he had discovered blue metal only an arm's length below where they sat. He almost called Tom's attention to his find, and then thought better of it. The thought that they were sitting less than 2 feet above a traffic jam, less than 2 feet above God only knew how many dead bodies, was an unsettling one. When Tom woke up on the morning of the 25th at 6:45, he found Stu already up and cooking breakfast, which was something of an oddity. Tom was almost always up before Stu. There was a pot of Campbell's vegetable soup hanging over the fire, just coming to a simmer. Kojak was watching it with great enthusiasm. "Morning, Stu," Tom said, zipping his jacket and crawling out of his sleeping bag and his shelter half. He had to whiz something terrible. "Morning," Stu answered casually. "And a Merry Christmas."
"Christmas?"
Tom looked at him and forgot all about how badly he had to whiz.
"Christmas?"
he said again. "Christmas morning." He hooked a thumb to Tom's left. "Best I could do." Stuck into the snow crust was a spruce top about 2 feet high. It was decorated with a package of silver icicles Stu had found in the back room of the Avon 5 and 10.
"A tree,"
Tom whispered, awed.
"And presents. Those are presents, aren't they, Stu?"
There were 3 packages on the snow under the tree, all of them wrapped in light blue tissue paper with silver wedding bells on it. There had been no Christmas paper at the 5 and 10, not even in the back room. "They're presents, all right," Stu said. "For you. From Santa Claus, I guess." Tom looked indignantly at Stu.
"Tom Cullen knows there's no Santa Claus, laws no. They're from you."
He began to look distressed.
"And I never got you one thing. I forgot. I didn't know it was Christmas. I'm stupid, stupid."
He balled up his fist and struck himself in the center of the forehead. He was on the verge of tears. Stu squatted on the snow crust beside him.
"Tom," he said, "you gave me my Christmas present early."
"No, sir, I never did. I forgot. Tom Cullen's nothing but a dummy. M-O-O-N, that spells dummy."
"But you did, you know. The best one of all. I'm still alive. I wouldn't be if it wasn't for you."
Tom looked at him uncomprehendingly.
"If you hadn't come along when you did, I would have died in that washout west of Green River. And if it hadn't been for you, Tom, I would have died of pneumonia or the flu or whatever it was back there in the Utah Hotel. I don't know how you picked the right pills. If it was Nick or God or just plain old luck, but you did. You got no sense calling yourself a dummy. If it hadn't been for you, I never would have seen this Christmas. I'm in your debt."
Tom said, "Aw, that ain't the same." But he was glowing with pleasure.
"It is the same," Stu said seriously.
"Well, go on, open your presents. See what he brung you.
I heard a sleigh in the middle of the night for sure. Guess the flu didn't get up to the North Pole."
"You heard him?"
Tom was looking at Stu carefully to see if he was being ribbed.
Heard something.
Tom took the first package and unwrapped it carefully. A pinball machine encased in Lucite, a new gadget all the kids had been yelling for the Christmas before, complete with 2-year coin batteries. Tom's eyes lit up when he saw it.
Turn it on, Stu said.
No, I want to see what else I got.
There was a sweatshirt with a winded skier on it, resting on crooked skis and propping himself up with his ski poles.
It says, I climbed Loveland Pass, Stu told him. We haven't yet, but I guess we're getting there.
Tom promptly stripped off his parka, put the sweatshirt on, and then replaced his parka.
Great! Great, Stu!
The last package, the smallest, contained a simple silver medallion on a fine-link silver chain. To Tom, it looked like the number 8 lying on its side. He held it up in puzzlement and wonder.
What is it, Stu?
It's a Greek symbol. I remember it from a long time ago on a doctor program called Ben Casey. It means infinity, Tom. Forever.
He reached across to Tom and held the hand that held the medallion.
I think maybe we're going to get to Boulder, Tommy. I think we were meant to get there from the first. I'd like you to wear that if you don't mind. And if you ever need a favor and wonder who to ask, you look at that and remember Stuart Redman. All right?
Infinity, Tom said, turning it over in his hand.
Forever.
He slipped the medallion over his neck.
I'll remember that, he said. Tom Cullen's gonna remember that.
Shit, I almost forgot. Stu reached back into his shelter half and brought out another package.
Merry Christmas, Kojak. Just let me open this for you.
He took off the wrappings and produced a box of Hart's Mountain Dog Yummies. He scattered a handful on the snow, and Kojak gobbled them up quickly. He came back to Stu, wagging his tail hopefully.
More later, Stu told him, pocketing the box. Make manners your watchword in everything you do, as old Baldy would say.
He heard his voice grow hoarse and felt tears sting his eyes. He suddenly missed Glenn, missed Larry, missed Ralph, and his cocked-back hat. Suddenly he missed them all, the ones who were gone, missed them terribly. Mother Abigail had said they would wade in blood before it was over, and she had been right. In his heart, Stu Redman cursed her and blessed her at the same time.
Stu, are you okay?
Yeah, Tommy, fine.
He suddenly hugged Tom fiercely, and Tom hugged him back.
Merry Christmas, old hoss.
Tom said hesitantly,
Can I sing a song before we go?
Sure, if you want.
Stu rather expected Jingle Bells or Frosty the Snowman sung in the off-key and rather toneless voice of a child. But what came out was a fragment of The First Noel, sung in a surprisingly pleasant tenor voice.
The First Noel.
Tom's voice drifted across the white wastes, echoing back with faint sweetness.
The angels did say, was to certain poor shepherds in fields as they lay. In fields as they lay, keeping their sheep, on a cold winter's night that was so deep.
Stu joined in on the chorus, his voice not as good as Tom's, but mixing well enough to suit the two of them, and the old sweet hymn drifted back and forth in the deep cathedral silence of Christmas morning.
Noel, 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 Christ is born in Israel.
That's the only part of it I can remember,
Tom said a little guiltily as their voices drifted away.
It was fine, Stu said.
The tears were close again. It would not take much to set him off, and that would upset Tom. He swallowed them back.
We ought to get going. Daylight's wasting.
Sure,
He looked at Stu, who was taking down his shelter half.
It's the best Christmas I ever had, Stu.
I'm glad, Tommy. And shortly after that, they were underway again, traveling east and upward, under the bright, cold Christmas Day sun. They camped near the summit of Loveland Pass that night, nearly 12,000 feet above sea level. They slept three in a shelter as the temperature slipped down to 20 degrees below zero. The wind swept by endlessly, cold as the flat blade of a honed kitchen knife, and in the high shadows of the rocks, with the lunatic star sprawl of winter seeming almost close enough to touch, the wolves howled. The world seemed to be one gigantic crypt below them, both east and west. Early the next morning, before first light, Kojak woke them up with his barking. Stu crawled to the front of the shelter half, his rifle in hand. For the first time, the wolves were visible. They had come down from their places and sat in a rough ring around the camp, not howling now, only looking. Their eyes held deep green glints, and they all seemed to grin heartlessly. Stu fired six shots at random, scattering them. One of them leaped high and came down in a heap. Kojak trotted over to it, sniffed at it, then lifted his leg and urinated on it.
The wolves are still his, Tom said. They always will be.
Tom still seemed half asleep. His eyes were drugged and slow and dreamy. Stu suddenly realized what it was. Tom had fallen into that eerie state of hypnosis again.
Tom, is he dead? Do you know?
He never dies, Tom said. He's in the wolves' laws, yes. The crows, the rattlesnake, the shadow of the owl at midnight, and the scorpion at high noon. He roosts upside down with the bats. He's blind like them.
Will he be back? Stu asked urgently.
He felt cold all over.
Tom didn't answer.
Tommy?
Tom's sleeping. He went to see the elephant.
Tom, can you see Boulder?
Outside, a bitter white line of dawn was coming up in the sky against the jagged, sterile mountaintops.
Yes. They're waiting. Waiting for some word. Waiting for spring. Everything in Boulder is quiet.
Can you see Franny?
Tom's face brightened.
Franny, yes. She's fat. She's going to have a baby, I think. She stays with Lucy Swan. Lucy's going to have a baby, too.
But Franny will have her baby first.
Except...
Tom's face grew dark.
Tom, except what?
The baby.
What about the baby?
Tom looked around uncertainly.
We were shooting wolves, weren't we? Did I fall asleep, Stu?
Stu forced a smile.
A little bit, Tom.
I had a dream about an elephant. Funny, huh?
Yeah. What about the baby? What about Fran?
He began to suspect they weren't going to be in time, that whatever Tom had seen would happen before they could arrive. The good weather broke 3 days before the new year, and they stopped in the town of Kittredge. They were close enough to Boulder now for the delay to be a bitter disappointment to them both. Even Kojak seemed uneasy and restless.
"Can we push on soon, Stu?"
Tom asked hopefully.
"I don't know," Stu said. "I hope so. If we'd only gotten 2 more days of good weather, I believe that's all it would have taken. Damn."
He sighed, then shrugged. "Well, maybe it'll just be flurries." But it turned out to be the worst storm of the winter. It snowed for 5 days, piling up drifts that were 12 and even 14 feet high in places. When they dug themselves out on the 2nd of January to look at a sun as flat and small as a tarnished copper coin, all the landmarks were gone. Most of the town's small business district had been not just buried, but entombed. Snowdrifts and snow dunes had been carved into wild, sinuous shapes by the wind.
They might have been on another planet. They went on, but the traveling was slower than ever. Finding the road had developed from a continuing nuisance into a serious problem. The snowmobile got stuck repeatedly, and they had to dig it out. And on the second day of 1991, the freight train rumble of the avalanches began again. On the 4th of January, they came to the place where U.S. 6 split off from the turnpike to go its own way to Golden. And although neither of them knew it, there were no dreams or premonitions. That was the day that Franny Goldsmith went into labor. "Okay," Stu said as they paused at the turnoff. "No more trouble finding the road, anyhow. It's been blasted through solid rock. We were damned lucky just to find the turnoff, though." Staying on the road was easy enough, but getting through the tunnels was not. To find the entrances, they had to dig through powdered snow in some cases and through the packed remains of old avalanches in others. The snowmobile roared and clashed unhappily over the bare road inside. Worse, it was scary in the tunnels, as either Larry or the trash can man could have told them. They were black as mine pits, except for the cone of light thrown by the snowmobile's headlamp, because both ends were packed with snow. Being inside them was like being shut in a dark refrigerator. Going was painfully slow. Getting out of the far end of each tunnel was an exercise in engineering. And Stu was very much afraid that they would come upon a tunnel that was simply impassable, no matter how much they grunted and heaved and shuffled the cars stuck inside from one place to another. If that happened, they would have to turn around and go back to the interstate. They would lose a week, at least. Abandoning the snowmobile was not an option. Doing that would be a painful way of committing suicide. And Boulder was maddeningly close. On January 7th, about 2 hours after they had dug their way out of another tunnel, Tom stood up on the back of the snowmobile and pointed. "What's that, Stu?" Stu was tired and grumpy and out of sorts. The dreams had stopped coming, but perversely, that was somehow more frightening than having them. "Don't stand up while we're moving, Tom. How many times do I have to tell you that? You'll fall over backward and go headfirst into the snow and..."
"Yeah, but what is it? It looks like a bridge. Did we get on a river someplace, Stu?"
Stu looked, saw, throttled down, and stopped.
"What is it?"
Tom asked anxiously.
"Overpass," Stu muttered.
I just don't believe it." "Overpass? Overpass?"
Stu turned around and grabbed Tom's shoulders.
"It's the Golden Overpass, Tom. That's 119 up there, Route 119, the Boulder Road. We're only 20 miles from town. Maybe even less."
Tom understood at last. His mouth fell open, and the comical expression on his face made Stu laugh out loud and clap him on the back. Not even the steady, dull ache in his leg could bother him now.
"Are we really almost home, Stu?"
"Yes, yes, yes!"
Then they were grabbing each other, dancing around in a clumsy circle, falling down, sending up puffs of snow, powdering themselves with the stuff. Kojak looked on, amazed. But after a few moments, he began to jump around with them, barking and wagging his tail. They camped that night in Golden and pushed on up 119 toward Boulder early the next morning. Neither of them had slept very well the night before. Stu had never felt such anticipation in his life, and mixed with it was his steady, nagging worry about Franny and the baby. About an hour after noon, the snowmobile began to hitch and lug. Stu turned it off and got the spare gas can lashed to the side of Kojak's little cabin. "Oh, Christ," he said, feeling its deadly lightness.
"What's the matter, Stu?"
"Me, I'm the matter. I knew that friggin' can was empty and I forgot to fill it. Too damn excited, I guess. How's that for stupid?"
"We're out of gas?"
Stu flung the empty can away.
"We sure God are. How could I be that stupid?"
"Thinking about Franny, I guess. What do we do now, Stu?"
"We walk, or try to. You'll want your sleeping bag. We'll split this canned stuff, put it in the sleeping bags. We'll leave the shelters behind. I'm sorry, Tom. My fault all the way."
"That's all right, Stu. What about the shelters?"
"Guess we better leave 'em, old hoss."
They didn't get to Boulder that day. Instead, they camped at dusk, exhausted from wading through the powdery snow which seemed so light but had slowed them to a literal crawl. There was no fire that night. There was no wood handy, and they were all three too exhausted to dig for it. They were surrounded by high, rolling snow dunes. Even after dark, there was no glow on the northern horizon, although Stu looked anxiously for it. They ate a cold supper, and Tom disappeared into his sleeping bag and fell instantly asleep without even saying good night. Stu was tired, and his bad leg ached abominably. "Be lucky if I haven't racked it up for good," he thought. But they would be in Boulder tomorrow night, sleeping in real beds. That was a promise. An unsettling thought occurred as he crawled into his sleeping bag. They would get to Boulder, and Boulder would be empty, as empty as Grand Junction had been, and Avon and Kittredge. Empty houses, empty stores, buildings with their roofs crashed in from the weight of the snow. Streets filled in with drifts. No sound but the drip of melting snow in one of the periodic thaws. He had read at the library that it was not unheard of for the temperature in Boulder to shoot suddenly up to 70 degrees in the heart of winter. But everyone would be gone, like people in a dream when you wake up, because no one was left in the world but Stu Redman and Tom Cullen. It was a crazy thought, but he couldn't shake it. He crawled out of his sleeping bag and looked north again, hoping for that faint lightning at the horizon that you can see when there is a community of people not too far distant in that direction. Surely he should be able to see something. He tried to remember how many people Glenn had guessed would be in the free zone by the time the snow closed down travel. He couldn't pull the figure out. 8,000? Had that been it? 8,000 people wasn't many. They wouldn't make much of a glow, even if all the juice was back on. Maybe you ought to get yourself some sleep and forget all this nutty stuff. Let tomorrow take care of tomorrow. He lay down, and after a few more minutes of tossing and turning, brute exhaustion had its way. He slept. And dreamed he was in Boulder, a summertime Boulder, where all the lawns were yellow and dead from the heat and lack of water. The only sound was an unlatched door banging back and forth in the light breeze. They had all left. Even Tom was gone. "Franny!" he called. But his only answer was the wind and that sound of the door, banging slowly back and forth. By 2 o'clock the next day, they had struggled along another few miles. They took turns breaking trail. Stu was beginning to believe that they would be on the road yet another day. He was the one that was slowing them down. His leg was beginning to seize up. "Be crawling pretty soon," he thought. Tom had been doing most of the trail breaking. When they paused for their cold canned lunch, it occurred to Stu that he had never even seen Franny when she was really big. Might have that chance yet. But he didn't think he would. He had become more and more convinced that it had happened without him, for better or for worse. Now, an hour after they had finished lunch, he was still so full of his own thoughts that he almost walked into Tom, who had stopped. "What's the problem?" he asked, rubbing his leg. "The road," Tom said, and Stu came around to look in a hurry. After a long, wondering pause, Stu said, "I'll be dipped in pitch." They were standing atop a snowbank nearly 9 feet high. Crusted snow sloped steeply down to the bare road below, and to the right was a sign which read simply, "Boulder City Limits." Stu began to laugh. He sat down on the snow and roared, his face turned up to the sky, oblivious of Tom's puzzled look. At last he said, "They plowed the roads, you see? We made it, Tom, we made it! Kojak, come here!" Stu spread the rest of the dog yummies on top of the snowbank, and Kojak gobbled them while Stu smoked and Tom looked at the road that had appeared out of the miles of unmarked snow like a lunatic's mirage. "We're in Boulder again," Tom murmured softly. "We really are. C-I-T-Y-L-I-M-I-T-S. That spells Boulder. Laws, yes." Stu clapped him on the shoulder and tossed his cigarette away. "Come on, Tommy, let's get our bad selves home."
Around 4 it began to snow again. By 6 p.m. it was dark, and the black tar of the road had become a ghostly white under their feet. Stu was limping badly now, almost lurching along. Tom asked him once if he wanted to rest, and Stu only shook his head. By 8, the snow had become thick and driving. Once or twice they lost their direction and blundered into the snowbanks beside the road before getting themselves reoriented. The going underfoot became slick. Tom fell twice, and then, around 8:15, Stu fell on his bad leg. He had to clench his teeth against a groan. Tom rushed to help him up. "I'm okay," Stu said, and managed to gain his feet. It was 20 minutes later when a young, nervous voice quavered out of the dark, freezing them to the spot.
"Who goes there?"
Kojak began to growl, his fur bushing up into hackles. Tom gasped, and just audible below the steady shriek of the wind, Stu heard a sound that caused terror to race through him, the snick of a rifle bolt being levered back. "Sentries. They've posted sentries. Be funny to come all this way and get shot by a sentry outside the Table Mesa Shopping Center. Real funny. That's one even Randall Flagg could appreciate."
"Stu Redman!" he yelled into the dark. "It's Stu Redman here!"
He swallowed and heard an audible click in his throat.
"Who's that over there?"
"Stupid. Won't be anyone that you know." But the voice that drifted out of the snow did sound familiar.
"Stu? Stu Redman?"
"Tom Collins with me. For Christ's sake, don't shoot us."
"Is it a trick?"
The voice seemed to be deliberating with itself.
"No trick. Tom, say something."
"Hi there,"
Tom said obediently. There was a pause. The snow blew and shrieked around them. Then the sentry, yes, that voice was familiar, called,
"Stu had a picture on the wall in the old apartment. What was it?"
Stu racked his brain frantically. The sound of the drawn rifle bolt kept recurring, getting in the way. He thought, "My God, I'm standing here in a blizzard trying to think what picture was on the wall in the apartment." "The old apartment," he said. "Fran must have moved in with Lucy. Lucy used to make fun of that picture, used to say that John Wayne was waiting for those Indians just where you couldn't see him."
"Frederick Remington," he bellowed at the top of his lungs. "It's called the War Path."
"Stu!"
the sentry yelled back. A black shape materialized out of the snow, slipping and sliding as it ran toward them.
"I just can't believe it!"
Then he was in front of them, and Stu saw it was Billy Gerringer, who had caused them so much trouble with his hot-rodding last summer.
"Stu! Tom! And Kojak, by Christ! Where's Glenn Bateman and Larry? Where's Ralph?"
Stu shook his head slowly. "Don't know. We got to get out of the cold, Billy. We're freezing."
"Sure. The supermarket's right up the road. I'll call Norm Kellogg, Harry Dunbarton, Dick Ellis. Shit, I'll wake the town. This is great. I don't believe it."
"Billy." Billy turned back to them, and Stu limped over to where he stood. "Billy, Fran was going to have a baby." Billy grew very still, and then he whispered,
"Oh, shit, I forgot about that."
"She's had it?"
George Richardson can tell you, Stu. Or Dan Lathrop. He's our new doc. We got him about 4 weeks after you guys left. Used to be a nose, throat, and ears man, but he's pretty good."
Stu gave Billy a brisk shake, cutting off his almost frantic babble.
"What's wrong?" Tom asked. "Is something wrong with Franny?"
"Talk to me, Billy," Stu said. "Please."
"Fran's okay," Billy said. "She's going to be fine."
"That's what you heard?"
"No, I saw her. Me and Tony Donahue, we went up together with some flowers from the greenhouse. The greenhouse is Tony's project. He's got all kinds of stuff growing there, not just flowers. The only reason she's still in is because she had to have a Roman birth."
"A cesarean section?"
"Yeah, right. Because the baby came the wrong way. But no sweat. We went to see her 3 days after she had the baby. It was January 7th we went up, 2 days ago. We brought her some roses. We figured she could use some cheering up because—"
"The baby died?" Stu asked dully.
"It's not dead," Billy said, and then he added with great reluctance, "Not yet."
Stu suddenly felt far away, rushing through the void. He heard laughter and the howling of wolves. Billy said in a miserable rush,
"It's got the flu. It's got Captain Trips. It's the end for all of us, that's what people are saying. Franny had him on the 4th, a boy, 6 pounds 9 ounces, and at first he was okay, and I guess everybody in the zone got drunk. Dick Ellis said it was like V.E. Day and V.J. Day all rolled into one, and then on the 6th he just got it."
"Yeah, man," Billy said, and his voice began to hitch and thicken.
"He got it. Oh, shit, ain't that some welcome home? I'm so fucking sorry, Stu."
Stu reached out, found Billy's shoulder, and pulled him closer.
"At first everybody was saying he might get better. Maybe it's just the ordinary flu, or bronchitis, maybe the croup. But the docs, they said newborn babies almost never get those things. It's like a natural immunity because they're so little. And both George and Dan, they saw so much of the super flu last year."
"That it would be hard for them to make a mistake," Stu finished for him.
"Yeah," Billy whispered. "You got it."
"What a bitch," Stu muttered.
He turned away from Billy and began to limp down the road again.
"Stu, where are you going?"
"To the hospital," Stu said, "to see my woman."
Chapter 76. Fran lay awake with the reading lamp on. It cast a pool of bright light over the left side of the clean white sheet that covered her. In the center of the light, face down, was an Agatha Christie. She was awake, but slowly drifting off, in that state where memories clarify magically as they begin to transmute themselves into dreams. She was going to bury her father. What happened after that didn't matter, but she was going to drag herself out of the shockwave enough to get that done. The act of love. When that was done, she could cut herself a piece of strawberry rhubarb pie. It would be large, it would be juicy, and it would be very, very bitter. Marcy had been in half an hour ago to check on her, and Fran had asked, "Is Peter dead yet?" And even as she spoke, time seemed to double so that she wasn't sure if she meant Peter the baby or Peter the baby's grandfather, now deceased.
"Shh, he's fine," Marcy had said,
but Franny had seen a more truthful answer in Marcy's eyes. The baby she had made with Jess Ryder was engaged in dying somewhere behind 4 glass walls. Perhaps Lucy's baby would have better luck. Both of its parents had been immune to Captain Trips. The Zone had written off her Peter now and had pinned its collective hopes on those women who had conceived after July 1st of last year. It was brutal, but completely understandable. Her mind drifted, cruising at some low level along the border of sleep, conning the terrain of her past and the landscape of her heart. She thought about her mother's parlor where seasons passed in a dry age. She thought about Stu's eyes, about the first sight of her baby, Peter Goldsmith Redman. She dreamed that Stu was with her, in her room.
"Fran?"
Nothing had worked out the way it should have. All of the hopes had turned out to be phony, as false as those audio-animatronic animals at Disney World. Just a bunch of clockwork, a cheat, a false dawn, a false pregnancy, a... "Hey, Franny." In her dream, she saw that Stu had come back. He was standing in the doorway of her room, wearing a gigantic fur parka. Another cheat. But she saw that the dream Stu had a beard. Wasn't that funny? She began to wonder if it was a dream, when she saw Tom Cullen standing behind him. And was that Kojak sitting at Stu's heel? Her hand flew suddenly up to her cheek and pinched viciously, making her left eye water. Nothing changed.
"Stu?" she whispered.
"Oh my God, is it Stu?"
His face was deeply tanned, except for the skin around his eyes, which might have been covered by sunglasses. That was not a detail you would expect to notice in a dream.
She pinched herself again.
"It's me," Stu said, coming into the room. "Stop working yourself over, honey."
His limp was so severe he was nearly stumbling.
"Franny, I'm home."
"Stu," she cried. "Are you real? If you're real, come here." He went to her then,
and held her. Chapter 77 Stu was sitting in a chair drawn up to Fran's bed when George Richardson and Dan Lathrop came in. Fran immediately seized Stu's hand and squeezed it tightly, almost painfully. Her face was set in rigid lines, and for a moment Stu saw what she would look like when she was old. For a moment she looked like Mother Abigail.
"Stu," George said, "I heard about your return. Miraculous. I can't tell you how glad I am to see you. We all are."
George shook his hand and then introduced Dan Lathrop. Dan said, "We've heard there was an explosion in Las Vegas. You actually saw it?"
"Yes."
"People around here seem to think it was a nuclear blast. Is that true?"
"Yes."
George nodded at this, then seemed to dismiss it and turned to Fran. "How are you feeling?"
"All right. Glad to have my man back. What about the baby?"
"Actually," Lathrop said, "that's what we're here about."
Fran nodded.
"Dead?"
George and Dan exchanged a glance.
"Franny, I want you to listen carefully and try not to misunderstand anything I say."
Lightly, with suppressed hysteria, Fran said,
"If he's dead, just tell me."
"Fran," Stu said.
"Peter seems to be recovering," Dan Lathrop said mildly.
There was a moment of utter shocked silence in the room. Fran, her face pale and oval below the dark chestnut mass of her hair on the pillow, looked up at Dan as if he had suddenly begun to spout some sort of lunatic doggerel. Someone, either Lori Constable or Marcy Spruce, looked into the room and then passed on. It was a moment that Stu never forgot.
"What?"
Fran whispered at last. George said, "You mustn't get your hopes up."
"You said recovering," Fran said.
Her face was flatly stunned. Until this moment, she hadn't realized how much she had resigned herself to the baby's death. George said,
"Both Dan and I saw thousands of cases during the epidemic, Fran. You notice I don't say treated, because I don't think either of us ever changed the course of the disease by a jot or a tittle in any patient. Fair statement, Dan?"
"Yes." The "I want" line that Stu had first noticed in New Hampshire hours after meeting her now appeared on Fran's forehead.
"Will you get to the point, for heaven's sake?"
"I'm trying, but I have to be careful, and I'm going to be careful," George said. "This is your son's life we're discussing, and I'm not going to let you press me. I want you to understand the drift of our thinking. Captain Trips was a shifting antigen flu, we think now. Now, every kind of flu, the old flu, had a different antigen. That's why it kept coming back every 2 or 3 years or so, in spite of flu vaccinations. There would be an outbreak of A-type flu, Hong Kong flu that was, and you'd get a vaccination for it. And then 2 years later, a B-type strain would come along, and you'd get sick unless you got a different vaccination."
"But you'd get well again," Dan broke in, "because eventually your body would produce its own antibodies. Your body changed to cope with the flu. With Captain Trips, the flu itself changed every time your body came to a defense posture. In that way, it was more similar to the AIDS virus than to the common sorts of flu our bodies have become used to. And as with AIDS, it just went on shifting from form to form until the body was worn out. The result, inevitably, was death."
"Then why didn't we get it?" Stu asked.
George said, "We don't know. I don't think we're ever going to know. The only thing we can be sure about is that the immunes didn't get sick and then throw the sickness off. They never got sick at all. Which brings us to Peter again. Dan?"
"Yes. The key to Captain Trips is that people seemed to get almost better, but never completely better. Now, this baby, Peter, got sick 48 hours after he was born. There was no doubt at all that it was Captain Trips. The symptoms were classic. But those discolorations under the line of the jaw, which both George and I had come to associate with the fourth and terminal stage of superflu, they never came. On the other hand, his periods of remission have been getting longer and longer."
I don't understand," Fran said, bewildered.
"What?"
"Every time the flu shifts, Peter is shifting right back at it," George said. "There's still the technical possibility that he might relapse,
but he has never entered the final critical phase. He seems to be wearing it out. There was a moment of total silence. Dan said, "You've passed on half an immunity to your child, Fran. He got it, but we think now he's got the ability to lick it. We theorize that Mrs. Wentworth's twins had the same chance, but with the odds stacked much more radically against them, and I still think that they may not have died of the superflu, but of complications arising from the superflu. That's a very small distinction, I know, but it may be crucial."
"And the other women who got pregnant by men who weren't immune?" Stu asked.
"We think they'll have to watch their babies go through the same painful struggle," George said, "and some of the children may die. It was touch and go with Peter for a while, and maybe again, from all we know now. But very shortly we're going to reach the point where all the fetuses in the free zone, in the world, are the product of two immune parents. And while it wouldn't be fair to pre-guess, I'd be willing to lay money that when that happens, it's going to be our ball game. In the meantime, we're going to be watching Peter very closely."
"And we won't be watching him alone, if that's any added consolation," Dan added.
"In a very real sense, Peter belongs to the entire free zone right now." Fran whispered, "I only want him to live because he's mine and I love him." She looked at Stu.
"And he's my link with the old world. He looks more like Jess than me, and I'm glad. That seems right. Do you understand, love?"
Stu nodded, and a strange thought occurred to him. How much he would like to sit down with Hap and Norm Bruett and Vic Palfrey and have a beer with them and watch Vic make one of his shitty-smelling home-rolled cigarettes and tell them how all of this had come out. They had always called him Silent Stu. Old Stu, they said. Wouldn't say shit if he had a mouthful. But he would talk their ears off their heads. He would talk all night and all day. He grasped Fran's hand blindly, feeling the sting of tears.
"We've got rounds to make," George said, getting up. "But we'll be monitoring Peter closely, Fran. You'll know for sure when we know for sure."
"When could I nurse him, if he doesn't—"
"A week," Dan said.
"But that's so long."
"It's going to be long for all of us. We've got 61 pregnant women in the zone, and 9 of them conceived before the superflu. It's going to be especially long for them. Stu, it was good meeting you."
Dan held out his hand, and Stu shook it. He left quickly, a man with a necessary job to do and anxious to do it.
George shook Stu's hand and said, "I'll see you by tomorrow afternoon at the latest, hmm? Just tell Lori when would be the most convenient time for you."
"What for?"
"The leg," George said. "It's bad, isn't it?"
"Not too bad."
"Stu," Franny said, sitting up,
"what's wrong with your leg?"
"Broken, badly set, overtaxed," George said. "Nasty. But it can be fixed."
"Well," Stu said.
"Well, nothing. Let me see it, Stuart."
The "I want" line was back.
"Later," Stu said.
George got up.
"See Lori, all right?"
"He will," Franny said.
Stu grinned. "I will. Boss lady says so."
"It's very good to have you back," George said. 1,000 questions seemed to stop just behind his lips. He shook his head slightly and then left, closing the door firmly behind him.
"Let me see you walk," Franny said. The "I want" line still creased her brow.
"Hey, Franny, come on, let me see you walk."
He walked for her. It was a little like watching a sailor make his way across a pitching foredeck. When he turned back to her, she was crying.
"Oh, Franny, don't do that, honey."
"I have to,"
she said, and put her hands over her face. He sat beside her and took her hands away.
"No, no, you don't."
She looked at him nakedly, her tears still flowing.
"So many people dead. Harold, Nick, Susan. And what about Larry? What about Glenn and Ralph?"
"I don't know."
"And what's Lucy going to say?" "She'll be here in an hour. She comes every day, and she's 4 months pregnant herself." "Stu, when she asks you—"
"They died over there," Stu said, speaking more to himself than to her. "That's what I think. What I know in my heart."
Don't say it that way, Fran begged. Not when Lucy gets here. It will break her heart if you do.
I think they were the sacrifice. God always asks for a sacrifice. His hands are bloody with it. Why? I can't say. I'm not a very smart man. Perhaps we brought it on ourselves. All I know for sure is that the bomb went off over there instead of over here, and we're safe for a while. For a little while.
Is Flag gone? Really gone?
I don't know. I think we'll have to stand a watch for him. And in time, someone will have to find the place where they made the germs like Captain Tripp's, and fill that place up with dirt and seed the ground with salt and then pray over it. Pray for all of us. Much later that evening, not long before midnight, Stu pushed her down the silent hospital corridor in a wheelchair. Lori Constable walked with them, and Fran had seen to it that Stu had made his appointment.
"You look like you're the one that should be in that wheelchair, Stu Redman," Lori said.
"Right now it doesn't bother me at all," Stu said. They came to a large glass window that looked in on a room done in blues and pinks. A large mobile hung from the ceiling. Only one crib was occupied, in the front row. Stu stared in, fascinated. "Goldsmith Redman, Peter," the card at the front of the crib read. "Boy, birth weight, 6 pounds, 9 ounces. Mother, Francis Goldsmith, room 209. Father, Jesse Ryder, deceased." Peter was crying. His small hands were balled into fists. His face was red. There was an amazing swatch of dark black hair on his head. His eyes were blue, and they seemed to look directly into Stu's eyes, as if accusing him of being the author of all his misery. His forehead was creased with a deep vertical slash, an "I want" line. Franny was crying again. "Franny, what's wrong?"
"All those empty cribs," she said, and her voice became a sob. "That's what's wrong. He's all alone in there. No wonder he's crying, Stu. He's all alone. All those empty cribs, my God."
"He won't be alone for very long," Stu said, and put an arm around her shoulders. "And he looks to me as if he's going to bear up just fine. Don't you think so, Lori?" But Lori had left the two of them alone in front of the nursery window. Wincing at the pain in his leg, Stu knelt beside Franny and hugged her clumsily, and they looked in at Peter in mutual wonder, as if the child were the first that had ever been gotten upon the earth. After a bit, Peter fell asleep, small hands clenched together on his chest, and still they watched him and wondered that he should be there at all.
Chapter 78. May Day. They had finally put the winter behind them. It had been long, and to Stu, with his East Texas background, it had seemed fantastically hard. 2 days after his return to Boulder, his right leg had been rebroken and reset, and this time encased in a heavy plaster cast that had not come off until early April. By then the cast had begun to look like some incredibly complex road map. It seemed that everyone in the zone had autographed it, although that was a patent impossibility. The pilgrims had begun to trickle in again by the 1st of March, and by the day that had been the cut-off for income tax returns in the old world, the free zone was nearly 11,000 strong, according to Sandy Duchenne, who now headed a census bureau of a dozen persons, a bureau that had its own computer terminal at the First Bank of Boulder. Now he and Fran stood with Lucy Swan in the picnic area halfway up Flagstaff Mountain and watched the May Day chase. All the zone's children appeared to be involved, and not a few of the adults. The original May basket, bedecked with crepe ribbons and filled with fruit and toys, had been hung on Tom Cullen. It had been Fran's idea. Tom had caught Bill Geringer. Despite Billy's self-conscious disclaimer that he was too old for such kid games, he had joined with a will. And together they had caught the Upshaw boy. Or was it Upson? Stu had trouble keeping them all straight. And the three of them had tracked down Leo Rockway hiding behind Brentner Rock. Tom himself had put the tag on Leo. The chase ranged back and forth over West Boulder, gangs of kids and adolescents surging up and down the streets that were still mostly empty, Tom bellowing and carrying his basket. And at last it led back up here, where the sun was hot and the wind blew warm. The band of tagged children was some 200 strong, and they were still in the process of tracking down the last half dozen or so that were still out. In the process, they were scaring up dozens of deer that wanted no part of the game. 2 miles farther up, at Sunrise Amphitheater, a huge picnic lunch had been spread where Harold Lauder had once waited for just the right moment to speak into his walkie-talkie. At noon, 2,000 or 3,000 people would sit down together and look east toward Denver and eat venison and deviled eggs and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and fresh pie for dessert. It might be the last mass gathering the zone would ever have, unless they all went down to Denver and got together in the stadium where the Broncos had once played football. Now, on May Day, the trickle of early spring had swelled to a flood of immigrants. Since April 15th, another 8,000 had come in, and they were now 19,000 or so, temporarily at least. Sandy's Census Bureau could not keep up. A day when only 500 came in was a rare day. In the playpen, which Stu had brought up and covered with a blanket, Peter began to cry lustily. Fran moved toward him, but Lucy, mountainous and 8 months pregnant, was there first. "I warn you," Fran said, "it's his diapers. I can tell just by the way he sounds." "Looking at a little poo isn't going to cross my eyes." Lucy lifted an indignantly crying Peter from the playpen and shook him gently back and forth in the sunlight. "Hi, baby. What you doing? Not too much?" Peter blatted. Lucy set him down on another blanket they had brought up for a changing table. Peter began to crawl away, still blatting. Lucy turned him over and began to unsnap his blue corduroy pants. Peter's legs waved in the air. "Why don't you two go for a walk?" Lucy said. She smiled at Fran, but Stu thought the smile was sad. "Why don't we just do that?" Fran agreed, and took Stu's arm. Stu allowed himself to be walked away. They crossed the road and entered a mild green pasture that climbed upward at a steep angle under the moving white clouds and bright blue sky. "What was that about?" Stu asked.
"Pardon me?"
But Fran looked just a trifle too innocent.
"That look."
"What look?"
"I know a look when I see one," Stu said. "I may not know what it means, but I know it when I see it."
"Sit down with me, Stu."
"Like that, is it?"
They sat down and looked east, where the land fell away in a series of swoops to flatlands that faded into a blue haze. Nebraska was out there in that haze somewhere.
"It's serious, and I don't know how to talk to you about it, Stuart."
"Well, you just go on the best you can," he said, and took her hand.
Instead of speaking, Fran's face began to work. A tear spilled down her cheek, and her mouth drew down, trembling.
"Fran."
"No, I won't cry," she said angrily.
And then there were more tears, and she cried hard in spite of herself. Bewildered, Stu put an arm around her and waited. When the worst seemed to be over, he said,
"Now tell me, what's this about?"
"I'm homesick, Stu. I want to go back to Maine."
Behind them, the children whooped and yelled. Stu looked at her, utterly flabbergasted. Then he grinned a little uncertainly.
"That's it? I thought you must have decided to divorce me at the very least. Not that we've ever actually had the benefit of the clergy, as they say."
"I won't go any place without you," she said.
She had taken a Kleenex from her breast pocket and was wiping her eyes with it.
"Don't you know that?"
"I guess I do."
"But I want to go back to Maine. I dream about it."
"Don't you ever dream about East Texas, Stu? Arnett?"
"No," he said truthfully. "I could live just as long and die just as happy if I never saw Arnett again." "Did you want to go to Ogunquit, Franny?"
"Eventually, maybe, but not right away. I'd want to go to Western Maine, what they called the Lakes region. You were almost there when Harold and I met you in New Hampshire. There's some beautiful places, Stu. Bridgeton, Sweden, Castle Rock. The lakes would be jumping with fish, I'd imagine.
In time, we might settle on the coast, I suppose. But I couldn't face that first year. Too many memories. It would be too big at first. The sea would be too big. She looked down at her nervously plucking hands. If you want to stay here, help them get it going, I understand. The mountains are beautiful too, but it just doesn't seem like home. He looked east and discovered he could at last name something he had felt stirring around in himself since the snow had begun to melt. An urge to move on. There were too many people here. They weren't exactly stepping all over each other, at least not yet. But they were beginning to make him feel nervous. There were zoners, and so they had begun to call themselves, who could cope with that sort of thing, who actually seemed to relish it. Jack Jackson, who headed the new Free Zone Committee, now expanded to 9 members, was one. Brad Kitchener was another. Brad had 100 projects going, and all the warm bodies he could use to help with each of them. It had been his idea to get one of the Denver TV stations going. It showed old movies every night from 6 to 1 a.m. with a 10-minute news broadcast at 9 o'clock. And the man who had taken over the marshalling chore in Stu's absence, Hugh Petrella, was not the sort of man Stu much cottoned to. The very fact that Petrella had campaigned for the job made Stu feel uneasy. He was a hard, puritanical fellow with a face that looked as if it had been carved by licks of a hatchet. He had 17 deputies and was pushing for more at each Free Zone committee meeting. If Glenn had been here, Stu thought he would have said that the endless American struggle between the law and freedom of the individual had begun again. Petrella was not a bad man, but he was a hard man, and Stu supposed that, with Hugh's sure belief that the law was the final answer to every problem, he made a better marshal than Stu himself ever would have been. "I know you've been offered a spot on the committee," Fran was saying hesitantly. "I got the feeling that was an honorary thing, didn't you?" Fran looked relieved. "Well, I got the idea they'd be just as happy if I turned it down. I'm the last holdover from the old committee, and we were a crisis committee. Now there's no crisis." "What about Peter, Franny?"
"I think he'll be old enough to travel by June," she said, "and I'd like to wait until Lucy has her baby."
There had been 18 births in the zone since Peter had come into the world on January 4th. 4 had died. The rest were just fine. The babies born of the plague-immune parents would begin to arrive very soon, and it was entirely possible that Lucy's would be the first. She was due on June 14th.
"What would you think about leaving on July 1st?" he asked.
Fran's face lit up.
"You will? You want to?"
"Sure."
"You're not just saying that to please me."
"No," he said. "Other people will be leaving too. Not many, not for a while, but some."
She flung her arms around his neck and hugged him.
"Maybe it will be just a vacation," she said. "Or maybe we'll really like it."
She looked at him timidly.
"Maybe we'll want to stay."
He nodded.
"Maybe so."
But he wondered if either of them would be content to stay in one place for any run of years. He looked over at Lucy and Peter. Lucy was sitting on the blanket, bouncing Peter up and down. He was giggling and trying to catch Lucy's nose.
"Have you ever thought that he might get sick? And you? What if you catch pregnant again?"
She smiled. "There are books. We can both read them. We can't live our lives afraid, can we?"
"No, I suppose not."
"Books and good drugs. We can learn to use them, and as for the drugs that have gone over, we can learn to make them again. When it comes to getting sick and dying." She looked back toward the large meadow where the last of the children were walking toward the picnic area, sweaty and winded.
"That's going to happen here, too. Remember Rich Moffat?"
He nodded.
"And Shirley Hammett?"
"Yes."
Shirley had died of a stroke in February. Franny took his hands. Her eyes were bright and shining with determination.
"I say we take our chances and live our lives the way we want."
"All right. That sounds good to me. That sounds right."
"I love you, East Texas."
"That goes back to you, ma'am."
Peter had begun to cry again. "Let's go see what's wrong with the Emperor," she said, getting up and brushing grass from her slacks.
"He tried to crawl and bumped his nose," Lucy said, handing Peter to Fran.
"Poor baby."
"Poor baby," Fran agreed, and put Peter on her shoulder. He laid his head familiarly against her neck, looked at Stu, and smiled. Stu smiled back.
"Peek, baby," he said, and Peter laughed.
Lucy looked from Fran to Stu and back to Fran again.
"You're going, aren't you? You talked him into it."
"I guess she did," Stu said. "We'll stick around long enough to see which flavor you get, though."
"I'm glad," Lucy said.
From far off, a bell began to clang in strong, musical notes which seemed to beat themselves into the day.
"Lunch," Lucy said, getting up. She patted her gigantic belly.
"Hear that, Junior? We're going to eat."
"Ow! Don't kick. I'm going."
Stu and Fran got up, too.
"Here, you take the boy," Fran said.
Peter had gone to sleep. The three of them walked up the hill to Sunrise Amphitheater together. Dusk of a summer evening. They sat on the porch as the sun went down and watched Peter as he crawled enthusiastically through the dust of the yard. Stu was in a chair with a caned seat. The caning had been belled downward by years of use. Sitting at his left was Fran in the rocker. In the yard, to Peter's left, the donut-shaped shadow of the tire swing printed its depthless image in the ground in the day's kind last light.
"She lived here a long time, didn't she?" Fran asked softly.
"Long and long," Stu agreed, and pointed at Peter. "He's getting all dirty."
"There's water. She had a hand pump. All it takes is priming. All the conveniences, Stuart."
He nodded and said no more. He lit his pipe, taking long puffs. Peter turned around to make sure they were still there.
"Hi, baby," Stu said, and waved.
Peter fell over. He got back up on his hands and knees and began to creep around in a large circle again. Standing at the end of the dirt road that cut through the wild corn was a small Winnebago camper with a winch attachment on the front. They were sticking to secondary roads, but the winch had still come in handy again and again.
"Are you lonely?" Fran asked.
"No. I may be in time."
"Scared about the baby?"
She patted her stomach, which was still perfectly flat.
"Nope." "It's going to put a scab on Pete's nose."
"It'll fall off. And Lucy had twins."
He smiled at the sky.
"Can you imagine it?"
"I saw them. Seeing's believing, they say."
"When do you think we'll be in Maine, Stu?"
He shrugged. "Near the end of July. In plenty of time to start getting ready for winter, anyhow."
"You worried?"
"Nope," she said, mocking him.
She stood up.
"Look at him. He's getting filthy."
"Told you."
He watched her go down the porch steps and gather up the baby. He sat there, where Mother Abigail had sat often and long, and thought about the life that was ahead of them. He thought it would be all right. In time, they would have to go back to Boulder, if only so their children could meet others their own age and court and marry and make more children. Or perhaps part of Boulder would come to them. There had been people who had questioned their plans closely, almost cross-examining them, but the look in their eyes had been one of longing rather than contempt or anger. Stu and Fran weren't the only ones with a touch of the wanderlust, apparently. Harry Dunbarton, the former spectacles salesman, had talked about Minnesota, and Mark Zellman had spoken of Hawaii, of all places, learning how to fly a plane and going to Hawaii.
"Mark, you'd kill yourself," Fran had scolded indignantly. Mark had only smiled slyly and said, "Look who's talking, Franny."
And Stan Nagotny had begun to talk thoughtfully about going south, perhaps stopping at Acapulco for a few years, then maybe going on down to Peru.
"I tell you what, Stu," he said, "all these people make me nervous as a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. I don't know one person in a dozen anymore. People lock their houses at night. Don't look at me that way, it's a fact. Listening to me, you'd never think I lived in Miami, which I did for 16 years, and locked the house every night, but damn, that was one habit I liked losing. Anyway, it's just getting too crowded. I think about Acapulco a lot.
Now, if I could just convince Janie... It wouldn't be such a bad thing, Stu thought, watching Fran pump water, if the free zone did fall apart. Glenn Bateman would think so, he was quite sure. Its purpose had been served, Glenn would say. Best to disband before... Before what? Well, at the last Free Zone committee meeting before he and Fran had left, Hugh Petrella had asked for and had been given the authorization to arm his deputies. It had been the cause in Boulder during his and Fran's last few weeks there. Everyone had taken a side. In early June, a drunk had manhandled one of the deputies and had thrown him through the plate glass window of the Broken Drum, a bar on Pearl Street. The deputy had needed over 30 stitches and a blood transfusion. Petrella had argued it never would have happened if his man had had a police special to point at the drunk. And so the controversy raged. There were plenty of people, and Stu was among them, although he kept his opinions mostly to himself, who believed that if the deputy had had a gun, the incident might have ended with a dead drunk instead of a wounded deputy. "What happens after you give guns to the deputies?" he asked himself. "What's the logical progression?" And it seemed that it was the scholarly, slightly dry voice of Glenn Bateman that spoke an answer. "You give them bigger guns, and police cars. And when you discover a free zone community down in Chile or maybe up in Canada, you make Hugh Petrella the Minister of Defense just in case, and maybe you start sending out search parties. Because, after all, that stuff is lying around, just waiting to be picked up." "Let's put him to bed," Fran said, coming up the steps. "Okay. Why are you sitting around in such a blue study, anyhow?" "Was I?" "You certainly were." He used his fingers to push the corners of his mouth up in a smile. "Better?" "Much. Help me put him in." "My pleasure." As he followed her inside Mother Abigail's house, he thought it would be better, much better, if they did break down and spread. Postpone organization as long as possible. It was organization that always seemed to cause the problem. When the cells began to clump together and grow dark, you didn't have to give the cops guns until the cops couldn't remember the names, the faces. Fran lit a kerosene lamp and it made a soft yellow glow. Peter looked up at them quietly, already sleepy. He had played hard. Fran slipped him into a nightshirt. "All any of us can buy is time," Stu thought. "Peter's lifetime, his children's lifetimes, maybe the lifetimes of my great-grandchildren. Until the year 2100, maybe. Surely no longer than that. Maybe not that long. Time enough for poor old Mother Earth to recycle herself a little. A season of rest." "What?" she asked. And he realized he had murmured it aloud. "A season of rest," he repeated. "What does that mean?" "Everything," he said, and took her hand. Looking down at Peter, he thought, "Maybe if we tell him what happened, he'll tell his own children, warn them. Dear children, the toys are death. They're flash burns and radiation sickness and black choking plague. These toys are dangerous. The devil in men's brains guided the hands of God when they were made. Don't play with these toys, dear children, please, not ever. Not ever again. Please, please learn the lesson. Let this empty world be your copybook." "Franny," he said, and turned her around so he could look into her eyes. "What, Stuart? Do you think people ever learn anything?" She opened her mouth to speak, hesitated, fell silent. The kerosene lamp flickered. Her eyes seemed very blue. "I don't know," she said at last. She seemed unpleased with her answer. She struggled to say something more, to illuminate her first response, and could only say it again. "I don't know." The circle closes. "We need help," the poet reckoned. Edward Dorn. He awoke at dawn. He had his boots on. He sat up and looked around himself. He was on a beach as white as bone. Above him, a ceramic sky of cloudless blue stood tall and far. Beyond him, a turquoise sea broke far out upon a reef and then came in gently, surging up and between strange boats that were canoes, outrigger canoes. He knew that, but how? He got to his feet and almost fell. He was shaky, bad off, felt hung over. He turned around. Green jungle seemed to leap out at his eyes, a dark forested tangle of vines and broad leaves and lush blooming flowers that were as pink as a chorus girl's nipple. He was bewildered again. What was a chorus girl? For that matter, what was a nipple? A macaw screamed at the sight of him, flew away blindly, crashed into the thick bole of an old banyan tree, and fell dead at the foot of it with its legs sticking up. Sat him on the table with his legs sticking up. A mongoose looked at his flushed, beard-scruffy face and died of a brain embolism. In come Sis with a spoon and a glass. A beetle that had been trundling busily up the trunk of a nipple-palm turned black and shriveled to a husk with tiny blue bolts of electricity frizzing for a moment between its antennae. And start stipping gravy from its yes, yes, yes. Who am I? He didn't know. Where am I? What did it matter? He began to walk, stagger, toward the verge of the jungle. He was lightheaded with hunger. The sound of the surf boomed hollowly in his ears like the beat of crazy blood. His mind was as empty as the mind of a newborn child. He was halfway to the edge of the deep green when it parted and three men came out. Then four. Then there were half a dozen. They were brown, smooth-skinned folk. They stared at him. He stared back. Things began to come. The six men became eight. The eight became a dozen. They all held spears. They began to raise them threateningly. The man with the beard stubble on his face looked at them. He was wearing jeans and old sprung cowboy boots. Nothing else. His upper body was as white as the belly of a carp and dreadfully wasted. The spears came all the way up. Then one of the brown men, the leader, choked out one word over and over again, a word that sounded like Yunna. Yup, things were coming. Rightio. His name, for one thing. He smiled. That smile was like a red sun breaking through a black cloud. It exposed bright white teeth and amazing blazing eyes. He turned his lineless palms out to face them in the universal gesture of peace. Before the force of that grin, they were lost. The spears fell to the sand. One of them struck point down and hung there at an angle, quivering. "Do you speak English?" They only looked. "Habla español?" No, they didn't. They definitely did not habla fucking español. What did that mean? Where was he? Well, it would come in time. Rome wasn't built in a day, nor Akron, Ohio, for that matter. And the place didn't matter. The place where you made your stand never mattered. Only that you were there, and still on your feet. Parlez-vous français? No answer. They stared at him, fascinated. He tried them in German, then bellowed laughter at their stupid, sheepy faces. One of them began to sob helplessly like a child. "They are simple folk, primitive, simple, unlettered. But I can use them. Yes, I can use them perfectly well." He advanced toward them, lineless palms still turned outward, still smiling. His eyes sparkled with warm and lunatic joy. "My name is Russell Faraday," he said in a slow, clear voice. "I have a mission." They stared at him, all eyes, all dismay, all fascination. "I have come to help you." They began to drop on their knees and bow their heads before him, and as his dark, dark shadow fell among them, His grin widened.
"I've come to teach you how to be civilized."
"Yunna!" The chief sobbed in joy and terror. And as he kissed Russell Faraday's feet, the dark man began to laugh. He laughed and laughed and laughed. Life was such a wheel that no man could stand upon it for long. And it always, at the end, came round to the same place again.
February 1975. December 1988.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Stand, Complete and Uncut, by Stephen King. This program was produced by Dan Zitt. Text copyright 1978-1990 by Stephen King. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.